This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In the 2010 midterm election, Republicans were swept into office in legislatures around the country in a tidal wave. Once in office, many enacted new state laws focused on the ballot box, primarily requiring some form of identification in order to vote. North Carolina joined those states in 2013, and now more than half the country has laws requiring voters to show some form of identification. But recent court rulings have turned the tide in the opposite direction, striking down those laws. That has just happened here in North Carolina. Even as state and local election officials scramble to comply with the court's order in time for November's general election, the governor and legislative leaders have asked the Supreme Court to step in. So this hour, we take a closer look at these laws, what they mandate, what the courts have said about these laws, and what this all means, and we'll look at it from both sides. Allison Riggs is senior attorney with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. She argued against North Carolina's voter ID law in district court, where she lost, and again at the Fourth Circuit Court, where she won. She joins us from studios at WUNC in Durham. Welcome to the program, Allison. And also with us across the desk from Allison is Mitch Kokai, senior political analyst with the John Locke Foundation, which of course favors the state's election laws. Thank you for being here, Mitch. And
thank you, Mike.
Sandwiched in the middle, figuratively, since he's in Charlotte, we've invited Dr. Michael Bitzer to join us. He's provost at and professor of political science at Catawba College in Salisbury. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you, Michael. When the Republicans were swept into office in 2010 and when the North Carolina legislature's Republican majority wrote and enacted our new election laws, which included voter ID provisions, what was the driving force? Why did they want to do it?
I think a lot of this was core Republican philosophy in terms of, from their perception, ensuring that there was integrity, accountability, to ensure the validity of the voting process. Now, you know, most research has shown that voter fraud in terms of people casting fraudulent ballots is very, very, very rare. But during the debate, there was a lot of discussion from legislators saying we need to protect the sanctity of this method of democratic participation.
This seemed to have happened in states around the country where Republican majorities took control of the legislature. Was it a concerted effort? Was it something directed by the National Republican Party or strongly suggested by the National Republican Party that Republicans in states take these actions?
I think Republicans had a banner year, particularly in 2010 when they took over a lot of legislatures and governorships, and they saw it as a core philosophical belief.
Republican National Committee?
I don't know if we can necessarily pinpoint it to one group or one person. You know, there's also talk about the influence of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, that propagated and really pushed for these kinds of measures along with other policy decisions. But certainly it was a core belief. And once you gain majority control, you get to do what you want.
So from a political scientist's point of view, was this a move to ensure the integrity, as you said a moment ago, of elections, to make sure that we minimize voter fraud to the lowest possible amount that it could be? Or was it a political maneuver focused on putting more Republicans in office down the road?
I think that there could be arguments on both of those issues and both sides. Certainly, the arguments that Republicans would make that it was about the integrity of the system. Democrats would argue that it targeted specific groups that tended to be much more Democratic allegiance in their voting patterns, for example, African-American voters. And so I think this is where both sides are using this to their advantage in terms of their political philosophies, but also in terms of partisanship, just simply as well.
We'll come back and talk about that at length in a minute or two. One more question for you before I move on to our guests in Durham. Just prior to North Carolina's enacting these election laws, the state was taken off a kind of probation, which had been in existence since the Civil Rights era, which made the state of North Carolina and other states were part of this as well, get approval from the Justice Department for any major changes to our election system. We'd had a history of racial discrimination in the state, and this probationary period was to ensure that we would not slip back into old habits. The Supreme Court ruled that we had learned our lesson, essentially, and that that oversight was no longer necessary, and almost instantly after that, these voter ID laws come into play. Is there a connection?
Well, this all has to do with the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and 40 counties in North Carolina were covered under the pre-clearance provision of the Voting Rights Act, which said any law that impacts voters or tries to retrogressively impact particularly minority voters had to be pre-cleared either by the Justice Department or a federal court. What the Supreme Court did was it argued to Congress to update the data from the late 1960s to make it more relevant in terms of what was happening in the 2000s. Congress didn't take up that call, and so in a case before the Supreme Court, they basically struck down the section that required the pre-clearance. The next day, this omnibus bill coincidentally gets introduced, and we have what we have before us.
Allison Riggs, you argued against this bill in the Fourth Circuit Court. Do you see a connection between the demise of these restrictions on certain states, including North Carolina, and the enactment of this new voter legislation?
Absolutely. The day the Shelby County decision came down, which is what Dr. Blitzer was referencing, Senator Apodaca, the chair of the Senate Rules Committee, which is a powerful Senate committee, said, great, now we can go with the full bill. And that marked the transformation of House Bill 589, which had been a still problematic but more reasonable voter ID law, transformed into a more stringent voter ID law, but more significantly added about 40 pages of text, pretty much reworking every section of North Carolina's election code, cutting early voting, cutting pre-registration, eliminating pre-registration, out-of-precinct voting, same-day registration, straight ticket voting, and also making changes to campaign finance laws in a way that certainly doesn't increase confidence in the electoral system.
So, Mitch, with the John Locke, what's the John Locke Foundation's position on this? Is there a connection in your mind between these two actions?
Well, there's interesting timing. The first thing I want to mention is the John Locke Foundation has generally supported voter ID, but really hasn't taken a position on some of the other things that were included in this law, like the end of the same-day registration or the cutback of the time frame for the early voting, pre-registration of the 16 and 17-year-olds. Those were all pieces of this law. Many of them are items that we really haven't taken a position on. The voter ID piece we have been in support of. But I think the reason that you saw the timing of the bill was that the legislature wanted to wait to see what the Supreme Court had to say. There was no reason for the General Assembly to put forward some provisions that would make changes to the election law and then have the Supreme Court come out and rule in a case and say, no, these are things that states can't do. So I think the reason that you saw the timing that you saw was that the legislature was wisely waiting to hear what the Supreme Court had to say. Once the Supreme Court had its say in a case that could impact North Carolina, then some ideas that had been floating around for a long time coalesced into this bill. And back to the whole point about voter ID, one of the things that we should keep in mind is that this is not a partisan left-right Republican versus Democratic issue. Voter ID has had, in all of the polls taken on it, substantial support from all groups, including Democrats, including African-American voters. My suspicion is if you would take a poll now, the support among Democrats and among African-Americans would have dropped since the last time major polls were done on this because of the drumbeat of attacks from the Democratic Party. But several years ago, we're talking about 2014, 2015, polls were consistently showing across the board 70% or more support for voter ID, including more than 50% among Democrats and more than 50% among African Americans. So I think when Republicans were going forward with voter ID, one of the things they said is, hey, this is, as Dr. Bitzer said, one of our core ideas, and it has popular support. Mm-hmm. Win-win for us.
Allison, the day that this law was signed this bill was signed into law by the governor in 2013, the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU of North Carolina Legal Foundation, and your organization, the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, filed this lawsuit. You declared this law to be unconstitutional. On what basis?
We raised a number of claims. We said that the law was racially discriminatory in violation of the 14th Amendment, that it created unjustified burdens on the fundamental right to vote, and that it violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And so we approached it from multiple angles and litigated all of those issues in district court and on appeal. And the Fourth Circuit on appeal agreed with us that the law was motivated by an intent to suppress African-American voting strength.
This was not the opinion of the first court that looked at this. The first court's decision was overturned by the Fourth Circuit. And in fact, Mitch, you say that the Fourth Circuit, rather than looking at highly detailed decisions, the highly detailed decision by this lower court basically said, facts be damned. Those are your words. Instead, they turned their attention to the state's history of discrimination and the impact of race on politics. And you say that was disappointing. Why? Why shouldn't they look at the history of all of this?
Well, certainly what you see from an appeals court, and I would have to add that I'm not an attorney and don't want to pretend to be, but the appeals court's role is to look at the trial court's decision and see if there's something that the trial court got wrong. Judge Schroeder put out a decision that was nearly 500 pages looking at the facts of the case. And after looking at fact after fact after fact, he said, no, there's no evidence that the General Assembly went forward in a way that was intentionally racially discriminatory. The appeals court, at the beginning of its opinion, said, well, you know, the Judge Schroeder put forward this massive argument or massive opinion, and that's all well and good, but he didn't look at the history of race in North Carolina politics, and he should have. And so we're basically going to set aside what the trial court found and look for evidence that would support our argument that race did play a role. And that just does not seem to be the proper role of an appellate court.
And that's actually not what the Fourth Circuit did. The Fourth Circuit applied this is the area of law in which I practice. They applied a well-established framework for considering circumstantial evidence of intent to discriminate. And what we've been saying all along in this case are that the critical facts are undisputed. No one can dispute the process facts. No one can dispute the effect facts, the usage facts. And so what the Fourth Circuit said was, all of these facts are undisputed. The court below just drew the wrong legal conclusions from these facts and said what the district court did in its 500-page opinion was miss the forest for the trees. He examined each piece of evidence in isolation, found some way to justify it, and then moved on to the next piece of evidence without looking at the totality of the evidence, which the Fourth Circuit said leads to only one conclusion, and that's what they ruled.
I want to follow up on what you just said, because I think that's the crux, or that's a key to the differences in these two court rulings. Mm-hmm. How these judges looked at all of this, right. But we have to take a break. We'll have to take a break and come back and do that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Mint Museum, where the exhibition Here and Now, 80 Years of Photography at the Mint, is on view at Mint Museum Uptown through September 18th. Details available at mintmuseum.org. And Nabu Scholar, preserving family histories by using interviews to craft customized autobiographies. Detailed information at nabuscholar.com. Well, on tomorrow's local news roundup, the Mecklenburg Board of Election cuts the total hours for early voting. Governor McCrory asked the Supreme Court to reinstate our new voter laws. Donald Trump stops in Charlotte for a rally just days after making changes in his campaign staff. The Panthers, well, they lose a preseason game and wrap up their training camp in Spartanburg. And the Hornets, their home gets a new name. Just some of the stories we'll be talking about with our roundtable of reporters tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, health insurance giant Aetna will stop selling insurance through most state exchanges created by the Affordable Care Act. It's the third major insurer to pull back. Who's affected? What it means for the future of the ACA.
That conversation on the Diane Rehm Show following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about voter ID laws, and specifically in North Carolina, the overturning of our voter ID law by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, with Allison Riggs, the senior attorney for the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, who argued that case both in district court and later in the circuit court and won. Mitch Kokai also joins us, senior political analyst for the John Locke Foundation. He's on the other side of this in certain parts of this law, and Dr. Michael Bitzer, a political scientist from Catawba College. Let me get back to what you were talking about just prior to the break, Allison, and that is that the circuit court said the district court had missed the forest for the trees in this in their original assessment, and that they had examined the law in isolation. The circuit court followed the Supreme Court's argument that you can look at circumstantial evidence to come to a reasonable conclusion about discriminatory intent, and that history comes into play here as context. Does that bode well for this case as it goes toward the Supreme Court?
I think the faithful application of Supreme Court precedent to the facts in this case certainly does. The procedural posture we find ourselves in now is on an emergency appeal, but there will be a full appeal later, and that will flesh out some of those details. But the Fourth Circuit's legal analysis is very well founded, and the facts are largely undisputed. So I think that does bode very well.
And in district court, where you lost the argument, the case was broken into two trials, as we all remember, because it happened around election time. One focusing on early voting and out-of-precinct voting and same-day voter registration. The second trial focused on voter ID. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down the lower court, as we just talked about. Given that the district court judge was a George W. Bush appointee, and the three-judge panel at the appeals court were Democratic appointees. Mm-hmm. Is this politics at play, Dr. Bitzer?
Shocking that you would raise that, but indeed. Judges, and we like to think of judges, particularly U.S. Supreme Court justices, as nonpartisan. They only look at the facts. They only apply the law as written and as interpreted. But if you're talking about interpretation, personal opinions and philosophical beliefs will shape how you look at words, and words matter. So certainly the partisanship is not just in our legislature and executives, but also in our judiciary. And certainly the philosophical beliefs that these judges have about this controversial issue, about voting, about racial discrimination, and where is the intent therein lies, is certainly framed by one's partisanship.
I know, Mitch, you agree with the district court's decision. Is that what you see at work here, politics?
It certainly seems to be playing a role. Obviously, one of the things that you see is that partisans on both sides will always look at a court case, and if the judge rules the way that they like, they'll say, well, the judge was just being impartial and looking at the law the way they should be looking at it. And if the decision goes the way that the particular speaker doesn't like, they'll look at the partisan affiliation, and if it's on the other side, they'll say, well, it's a case of partisan judges. I think one of the
things. Or judicial activism.
Judicial activism. One of the things that people might want to know about one of the judges who's been involved in more than one of these decisions now on three-judge panels is that Appeals Court Judge Jim Wynn used to be an appeals court judge in North Carolina and had a history more than once of being appointed to office by a Democrat and then being voted out of office by the voting population of North Carolina. So one suspects that however James Wynn approaches this role on the appellate court, he, at least at the back of his mind, doesn't have a great amount of respect for the voters of North Carolina, who on at least two occasions said they didn't want him to be their judge when he was the sitting incumbent.
The court ended its ruling, the Fourth Circuit Court ended its ruling by calling this law monumental in terms of disenfranchisement. How unusual is a statement like that from a court? Dr. Bridge.
It was pretty clear what they were getting at very early on. When I read the opinion, it was a pretty sharp rebuke to the district court judge, Judge Schroeder, in terms of, look, you looked at every leaf and you looked at every tree, but you didn't take into account the forest, as Allison noted. And it was a pretty strong rebuke in terms of judicial doctrine and belief.
We went through a couple of off-year elections, I think, while this law was in full force. The voter ID provisions had not gone into place until the primary list passed
March,
but everything else was in place, I think.
Right.
How were voters impacted, particularly African American voters? Was their turnout lower? Were fewer of them unable to vote under the provisions of this law?
Well, this is where you get into the discrepancy in terms of how you view data. At the district court, they noted that in 2014, African American votes in midterm elections actually went up. The percentage went up slightly. But the Circuit Court of Appeals argued they didn't take into account the full impact, and we've only been focused on the voter ID, but there was provisions about same-day voter registration.
Right.
There was provisions about early voting, the out-of-precinct voting. The Circuit Court of Appeals argued if you took into account the impact of those provisions as well, then it really was negligible in terms of the rise of African American vote in the state in 2014.
And we're going to talk more about that as we go through the hour, the rest of the hour with our three guests. But for the next couple of minutes, I want to bring in somebody else with a national perspective on this. Jennifer Clark, she's counsel with the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. They are a nonpartisan law and policy institute working to, in their words, hold our political institutions and laws accountable to the twin American ideals of democracy and equal justice for all. And voting rights is one of their particular areas of concern. Jennifer Clark joins us by phone from New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. In the last 5 to 6 years, 21 states, Jennifer, just under half the country has seen stricter voter laws enacted. Are all of these in Republican-controlled states?
All of them are not, but there is a correlation that has been studied. We have a study that came out a couple years ago out of University of Massachusetts, and there are others that have found similar conclusions that finds that as Republican control in a state legislature goes up, or as a Republican governor takes office in a state, there is that is correlated with more restrictions on voting. So it is certainly not a perfect match, and we have seen some Democratic-controlled states, such as Rhode Island, for example, pass some restrictive laws around voting. But generally speaking, the evidence does show that there is a correlation between Republican control in a state and restrictions on the right to vote.
And around the country where these laws have been enacted, has the reason given been that we want to reduce voter fraud?
Generally speaking, yes. That is oftentimes one of the main things that is cited. And the cases that we are seeing decisions in currently, you know, you guys have been talking about the North Carolina case, which is part of a kind of broader trend of litigation around the country right now. They're pretty much in every one of those cases. One of the reasons put forth by the legislature at the time was that they were saying that this particular restriction made it harder for people to commit voter fraud. That is one of the purported reasons.
You say this is a broader movement to curtail voting rights. Your organization, the Brennan Center for Justice, says 15 states have new voting restrictions in place for the first time in a presidential election this time around. And you call this, as I said, a broader movement to curtail voting rights. Why is this happening?
Sure. I think there are a couple of touch points that kind of explain the trend that we've seen over the past about 6 years. One is the 2010 election, which really brought a big shift in state legislatures around the country. As I discussed, you know, there is a correlation between state legislatures switching party control and heading in a Republican direction that seems to be correlated with cutbacks on the right to vote. And in 2010, we started to see a wave of that kind of shift in party control. So that's one main turning point. Another turning point that we saw was in 2013, which is when the Supreme Court issued its decision 5-4 in a case called Shelby County, which struck down a part of the Voting Rights Act that had required that had the result of such a certain states with a history of discrimination at the polls, they didn't have to get their voting laws pre-cleared. And so we have seen states that used to be under that part of the Voting Rights Act, such as North Carolina, such as Virginia, such as Arizona. Those are all states that didn't have to get these laws pre-cleared anymore, have put these laws into place, and are now facing litigation surrounding these restrictive voting laws. So those are a couple of the things along the way that have really helped usher in this wave of restriction.
And of the states who have recently enacted these laws, how many have had them struck down in whole or in part?
So there is a lot of litigation that remains ongoing and open right now. So that's a hard number to say because we are in the middle of a shifting landscape. Recently speaking, in addition to the decision coming out of North Carolina that you guys have been talking about, we saw a decision coming out of North Dakota in which that state cannot enforce its strict voter ID law for this election. And the question remains as to what happens to that law going forward. We have also had a decision in Texas out of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals there where that state also cannot enforce its strict photo ID law in this election. And there's kind of an open question as to what happens with the law after that. We also had a couple of decisions recently coming out of Wisconsin. We have a strict photo ID law that was passed there and some other cutbacks on voting, including restrictions on offering early voting. And it's kind of a mixed bag there. It seems right now that Wisconsin might be enforcing its strict photo ID law this November. But on the flip side, some of the cutbacks to early voting there have been struck down by a court. A court found that those were intentionally discriminatory as well. But this is very much a changing landscape and one that you have to keep paying attention to it as we head into the election.
The Fifth Circuit Court struck down Texas's voter ID law. You talked about Wisconsin. You talked about North Dakota. I think Kansas has a law that is in question at the moment. What makes these laws different from North Carolina's law, which was struck down? Or is there a difference? Does it matter? Is it a matter of the different court that looked at these laws?
Right. So the laws are all a little bit different. For example, the North Carolina law, as I'm sure everybody has been talking about, covered a broad array of things. It wasn't just a voter ID law. It hit on a lot of parts, pretty much every aspect of electoral administration. In Texas, by contrast, that was only about a strict photo ID law, although it was or is a very strict photo ID law that required really the smallest number of documents that we have seen so far. So there are some differences in the laws in terms of the precisely what the restrictions are. Another important distinction, in at least in terms of the court decisions and where we are now, is As you all were talking about, the Fourth Circuit found discriminatory intent, which is, you know, something that the plaintiffs in the Texas case are claim also happened in Texas as well, but we don't have a final decision on that yet. In Wisconsin, the intentional discrimination is not a claim that is still a live claim in the voter ID suit, but intentional discrimination was part of the allegations regarding the cutbacks to early voting there. So there are a lot of similarities.
But the cutbacks to early voting in Wisconsin, evidently the Wisconsin law attempted to make it harder for municipalities to offer early voting options to voters. Couldn't it be said that that's purposefully targeting lower income people who have hourly jobs, who can't necessarily stand in line for 4 hours on a single election day, and they need these early voting hours in order to participate? And wouldn't that be on its face discriminatory?
So, in fact, the district court, the federal trial court that recently issued an opinion in that case, agreed and found that the cutbacks on early voting, which, as you said, dealt with the ability of municipalities to offer certain amounts of early voting to their citizens, that court found that that was intentionally discriminatory, that they were that was designed to make it more difficult for certain classes of voters to vote. That is something that Wisconsin is appealing right now to the Seventh Circuit, so we don't have a final word on that matter, but certainly the district court saw it that way.
In states where these voter ID or these voter laws, and I guess not all of them are voter ID laws or called voter ID laws, but where they've been left to stand, what has the impact been on voting?
So certainly we have heard stories from folks who have had trouble voting under these laws, extreme trouble, and sometimes have not been able to vote at all. And those stories have correlated with the statistics and the expert evidence that we've seen coming out of these places. So, for example, you know, the Brennan Center is involved in the Texas litigation that I have been talking about. I serve as plaintiff's counsel there, and we had plenty of folks come to the trial in Corpus Christi in Texas and talk about how they didn't have one of the IDs that they needed to vote, and they were unable to get one because they didn't have their birth certificate anymore, or they weren't able to get, you know, multiple rides to a motor vehicle agency to get all the documents that they needed compiled. And so we have firsthand heard and seen voters who simply couldn't vote under these laws, and experts in Texas found that a little over 600,000 registered voters, in fact, are in that position, don't have the IDs that they need to vote.
When you talk about the stories that we have heard, are these anecdotal, or is there empirical, documented evidence that certain numbers of people have been denied or access or were unable to vote, and that's been documented by people at the polls?
So it's both. It certainly is anecdotal, and as I said, there is statistical evidence that we have around the number of people who simply don't have the IDs that you need to vote. It's a very hard thing to know exactly how many people aren't showing up to vote because they don't have the IDs. You know, that requires measuring a negative, so that is difficult, but we can find the stories of people who, you know, who come and, you know, testify in front of a court about all of the issues that they've run into and their inability to vote. And then we can see that reflected in the numbers of people who simply don't have those IDs.
Jennifer Clark is counsel for the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. I'm going to keep her just a few more minutes and as we bring this back to North Carolina with our other guests on this topic in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Kunane Group, building an enclave of single-family homes with classic American architecture at Cotswold Commons. More information at 704-752-9067 or kunanegroup.com. And British International School of Charlotte, dedicated to unleashing the potential of every child through its personal approach, international curriculum, and campus of 42 schools around the globe. BISCharlotte.org. Health insurance insurance giant Aetna will stop selling insurance through most state exchanges created by the Affordable Care Act, including that in North Carolina. It's the third major insurer to pull back from Obamacare. So on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, you'll talk about who's affected and what this means for the future of the Affordable Care Act. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can get to us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Using witty musical parody and satire, the Capital Steps poke fun at all sides of the issues and put the mock in democracy. You can see them live Friday, September 9th at the Bat Center at Wingate University. Become a WFAE member with a gift of just $10 per month, and we'll reserve space for you and a guest to attend this performance, as well as a special VIP meet and greet. Call 704-549-9000 or donate now at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about North Carolina's voter ID law, which was recently struck down by the Fourth Circuit Court and is now being asked by the governor to the Supreme Court is now being asked to consider this by the governor here in North Carolina. We're talking about this with Dr. Michael Bitzer, provost and political science professor at Catawba College in Salisbury, Allison Riggs, senior attorney for the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, which argued the case before the Fourth Circuit and won. Mitch Kokai, senior political analyst at the John Locke Foundation, and Jennifer Clark, counsel for the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. A couple more questions for Jennifer before I let her go here, but I want Allison to chime in on this too, and maybe Mitch as well. NPR's legal correspondent Nina Totenberg called the federal appeals court decision in North Carolina the biggest win for voting rights in the country. I'd like to get your opinion first, Jennifer, if Nina Totenberg is right about that.
Well, it's certainly, you know, it's a huge opinion, and it is a huge victory for a law that, you know, was so huge in all of the areas of voting that it attacked. So I would very much agree that it is a huge opinion, and certainly a finding of intentional discrimination is an incredibly important thing, because that is obviously the most concerning thing is that legislators who have been elected by citizens are, you know, sitting around and intentionally choosing who gets to vote and doing so based on something such as race. That is the nightmare scenario. And so certainly finding that out is hugely important. And, you know, as I said, it is a huge decision, and there are plenty of others that have been handed down as well. So I would say that it is part of a lot of decisions that we are seeing coming out right now that all push back against this wave of restrictions. And I'm hoping that we will see more of them coming down the pipe.
And Allison, I'm going to put all of my money on the wager that you agree with Nina Totenberg.
Well, I'll surprise you. I mean, it's a very important decision, but in some ways this was, of all of the cases out there now, this was the easiest call. This was a monster voter suppression law that surgically attacked and undermined every mechanism of voting disproportionately used by people of color in this state. So it wasn't a hard decision. It is important, but I think more than many other courts in the country, the Fourth Circuit was on solid ground, and it was an easy decision to make.
Mitch Kokai?
Obviously, I'm going to say that the big answer is no, because there was no cutback in the right to vote. Nothing that was put in place, whether it was good policy or bad policy, changed anyone's right to vote. We're talking about time, place, and manner restrictions that were applied equally to all voters, and that there, as the district court found, that there was no evidence, no real hard in fact evidence, rather than the sort of amateur mind reading that the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals tried to do, no hard and fast evidence that anyone was engaged in intentionally racially discriminatory actions. Everyone who had the right to vote before that law was put into place still had the right to vote after that law was put into place. Mm-hmm. The changes were all to the time, place and manner of the elections, and there was no intent to eliminate anyone's right to vote.
Jennifer,
the thousands of voters disenfranchised probably would disagree with that.
Jennifer, the Supreme Court is being asked in this case in North Carolina to get involved in this. I'm sure they'll be asked to get involved in other cases that have been decided by other district courts around the country. Given the split on the court that we have right now, are they likely to take the case? And if so, what might the outcome be? Or, in fact, will we have to wait until we have a circuit court come down on the other side of this so that we have a disagreement among the circuit courts?
Sure. I think you've identified the issue, which is that right now they are a hobbled court. They're not a full court. So I don't have any special insight, but my particular belief is that they would be unlikely to take it if they can avoid taking it at this stage in the game. We are in a scenario where we're starting to see different things come out of different circuits. The Seventh Circuit, for example, which is the circuit that includes Wisconsin, has issued a few opinions about its view on how the Voting Rights Act handles these kinds of claims, and they are out of line with, for example, the Fourth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit. So I think we do have at least the beginnings of a circuit split, but I think that the court would prefer to take this on when it has its full membership. So I think we might see something soon, but I don't think we're going to see anything definitive before the end of the year, for example.
Jennifer Clark is counsel for the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. Jennifer, thank you for taking time to talk to us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Early voting does provide more opportunities for working people to vote. More locations, more hours, more days, less waiting. But many of those people are African Americans or lower income people who tend to vote Democratic as opposed to Republican. So given that, and the fact that the circuit court said that the North Carolina law targeted African Americans with surgical precision, their words, how can any believable argument be made, Mitch, that race didn't play a factor in this?
Well, the problem that you have is that there is one factor that we know that the Republican legislature was motivated by in putting forward its ideas, and that is to help Republicans. I mean, that's how they move forward with redistricting. That's how they move forward with election laws. If there is something that helps Republicans, then the argument is made on the other side that because most African Americans are Democrats, that it is purposefully harming African Americans, when in fact what the motivation might have been is to help Republicans and thereby hurt Democrats. If there was an incidental impact on African Americans, that may have happened, but there certainly was no intent to harm African Americans.
That's what State Senator Bob Rucho of Mecklenburg County said. He said that the Fourth Circuit Court should be embarrassed by their ruling, and for the court to make a statement accusing the General Assembly of using race under the Voting Rights Act is outrageous. So, Dr. Bitzer, when we talked recently on this program, you and I, about redistricting, it is illegal under the Voting Rights Act to draw a district that precludes African Americans from voting. You can draw a district so that you can enhance the chances of a political party winning,
right?
But you can't do it so that one race or the other has the advantage. Could it not be argued that this and other laws like it, this voting law, does exactly that? It enhances the chances of Republicans winning, and that African Americans, and in the case of Texas, Latinos, are just collateral damage.
One could make that argument, but you also have to recognize that in North Carolina, we have a history of racially polarized voting, that certainly African Americans, by exit polls and other studies, vote for the Democratic Party 95% to 99% of the time. Whites tend to be overwhelmingly Republican. So there's a mixing of this politics and race that has been at the heart of North Carolina voting patterns for a very long time.
So given that we know that to be true, why is the drawing of districts allowed to be politically motivated as opposed to racially motivated when racial motivations come into play, or the aftermath of it is that you accomplish what your predecessors accomplished when they did it for the purposes of race?
Because the courts will not enter into what they declare as a political question. If a question arises based on politics, it needs to be determined by those who are popularly elected and accountable to the people. Now, the court has always held that partisan gerrymandering is perfectly legal and constitutional because, mm-hmm. guess what? To the victors go the spoils. Mm-hmm. And if you win in a year ending in zero, you can redistrict how you want to.
Now, the ruling said, if I'm not mistaken about this, Allison, the court's ruling said that the law is struck down and that North Carolina has to go back to the way they were doing business before the law was passed. And yet, we have an instance just this morning in the news of Mecklenburg County reducing voting hours because the Republican head of the Elections Commission says, I've never liked early voting very much. And in fact, an order came down from the state Republican Party to do this in districts across the state. Why is this not regarded as balking at the court's order?
It certainly is. And they've exposed themselves to enormous liability and potential litigation down the road by doing so. I will say there are many Republican County Board of Elections members who are smarter than their heads, than Woodhouse's directive. They know that voters of all ilks like early voting, and that restricting who can vote in order to maintain power is a stupid recipe for success long term. And so we saw Durham County just last night unanimously expand early voting opportunities, Republican-controlled board. So there are some examples of problematic counties, and the counties and the State Board of Elections are on notice that these actions are inconsistent with the ruling from the Fourth Circuit, and that there are other legal avenues available to challenge those. The Mecklenburg County's decision is going to come before the State Board of Elections, and so the State Board of Elections has the chance to correct that.
I wrote a blog piece.
Mike, can I?
Oh, go ahead, Mitch.
I was going to say, I just want to leap in on a couple of points related to that. One, first of all, the letter that came from Dallas Woodhouse, who is the executive director of the North Carolina Republican Party, was not an order to elections board members. And as Allison has pointed out, some of the boards have either ignored his email or read it and said, okay, we're going to go in another direction. But I think one of the things that should be noted is that part of the law that cut back the number of early voting days required that these county boards of elections have the same amount of early voting hours. So even though the number of days was cut back, the number of hours had to remain the same. The court's order, surprisingly, struck down that piece of the early voting change that cut back the number of days, but didn't say anything about the number of hours. And so there is no guarantee that people will end up having the same number of hours of early voting that they had before the law was changed.
Was that an oversight, Allison?
No. I mean, the same hours requirement was part and parcel of the cut to early voting. So, I mean, it fell when the cut to early voting fell. What is poor decision-making on the Mecklen County Board of Elections officials' part is that Mecklenburg County has grown enormously in the last 4 years. They had high volumes through early voting sites in 2012, and that's only going to be worse this year. So regardless of all these debates that we're having, people who are serving the best interest of the voters in their county need to be following the guidance of the State Board of Elections, which said, be mindful of historical voting patterns, be mindful of population changes. But getting to the Fourth Circuit's ruling, was to restore voting opportunities as they existed prior to 2013. And so what some counties, a relatively small number, but what some counties have done is very recalcitrant, balking at that ruling, And very risky for them long term.
I wrote a blog piece for thepartyline.org and looked at Mecklenburg County. 55% of all the ballots cast in 2012's general election came before Election Day through in-person early voting. And if you look at the breakdown in terms of race, white voters basically were split 48% used early in person, 48% on Election Day. In comparison, black voters, 70% of them cast their ballots before Election
Could Day. Could it be argued that Mecklenburg County could not handle Election Day if there weren't early voting?
I think Michael Dickerson would say if we don't have early voting, it is going to be a nightmare administratively scenario.
So we've been calling this the voter ID law, and that is not exactly what it is. And Mitch Kokai, you pointed that out, that most people agree with voter ID because it's hard to argue against the fact that if you go to to buy anything with a credit card, they ask to see your ID. So why shouldn't you be asked to see your ID when you vote? And provisions were made to make it easier for people to get legally recognized IDs. But just like HB 2, which is called the bathroom law, but in fact has so many more pieces to it than just bathrooms, the same is true of this law. Had this law been just about bringing an ID to the polls, would we be having this conversation today?
I think we'd still be having this conversation, but it would not have all of the elements that it would, because one of the interesting things I found in listening to the discussion you had with the Brennan Center expert is people who are thinking this is just about North Carolina and our evil Republican General Assembly ought to look at the national picture and see that there is a nationwide fight over voter ID, the rules regulations in place on the time, place, and manner of elections. There are opposing camps. They're fighting in court in multiple states. And it's all because the federal government is such a huge prize and plays such a large role in all of our lives that everyone wants to be the one in charge.
So, and we have a minute left. In North Carolina, in November, what will be required of voters? We have 30 seconds left, actually.
Unless the Supreme Court steps in, I think we can go to the polls without driver's licenses and the expanded voter early voting technique.
Okay. I want to thank Allison Riggs, the senior attorney for the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, for joining us from studios at WUNC in Durham, along with Mitch Kokai, senior political analyst for the John Locke Foundation, and Dr. Michael Bitzer, provost of and political science professor at Catawba College. Thank you all for the hour.